What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. From KPFA Radio and the Pacifica Network, I'm your host, Jesse Strauss. A new investigation into police use of tasers follows how they've been used specifically in response to 911 mental health calls. The research shows that they can cause death as well as long-term harm, and also that they are deployed disproportionately against Black people. The investigation was done by MindSight News, a nonprofit journalism site dedicated to reporting on mental health in the U.S., exposing rampant policy failures and spotlighting efforts to solve them. MindSight did this research in collaboration with the Medill School of Journalism at Northwestern University. Joining me to discuss are researcher and journalist Cela Breen, along with Josh McGee, MindSight Chicago bureau chief and reporter who focuses on the intersections of criminal justice and mental health. Cela and Josh, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for having us.
I'd like to start by bringing listeners into the broader story with a specific example. Cela, can you describe the experience of Gerontes Garrett, who had a police taser encounter in 2022?
Absolutely. Gerontes Garrett was a 20-year-old student and basketball player at Norwich University in Atlanta, and he was experiencing a pretty overwhelming time at home, and he was outside of a Hyatt hotel in Atlanta, and he was talking to himself, expressing suicidal ideations, according to the police report, and someone called 911 on him, and they required several officers to subdue him. And after about 3 hours, when an ambulance had not arrived to bring him to a hospital for a mental health check-in, he began to feel very uncomfortable and like he wanted to run away. He was scared. And he began to run away, and an officer grabbed Garrett's belt to prevent him from leaving. And he ended up firing a taser at Garrett into his arm and lower back. And then he was handcuffed and taken to jail and charged with disorderly conduct. He was taken to jail before he was transferred to Grady Memorial Hospital, where the staff did say he was experiencing a mental health crisis, is what the police report said.
All right. We're going to get way deeper into the context of how police end up in these situations using tasers to deal with mental health crises. But before we do that, for listeners who aren't aware of the specifics and the technology, I'm wondering, Josh or Cela, can you briefly talk about what a taser is, how powerful these tasers that police are using are, and how they're literally deployed into someone's body?
Yeah, so tasers are a conducted energy device. Conducted energy devices include tasers, stun guns, and they're basically these darts that are shot into a person's body to electrically shock them. And they're used to subdue people, and they're a use of force, but for a long time they were considered a less lethal use of force. However, they have obviously extremely harmful effects for people, both physically and mentally. And they're often used in mental health crises because they were considered less lethal. And because these people are having a mental health crisis rather than committing a crime, people sometimes think it's more appropriate to use that. However, it still results in a long-lasting trauma and can often result in death because people's heart rate is already up, and they often shock them multiple times.
One of the points of your research that really shocked me is a reference to forensic pathologist Joyce Carter. She's the nation's first African-American chief medical examiner, and she told you all that Axon, it's a company formerly called Taser International, has continuously pushed the idea that deaths happen because of excited delirium, not shock from tasers. Can you bring us into that conversation a little bit about what she's talking about with excited delirium and how these taser companies justify this use of force, which you've already described is not actually necessarily less than lethal?
So Josh spoke with Joyce, but I can explain a little bit about what excited delirium means. Excited delirium is a diagnosis that people use to describe death from tasers. We spoke with Douglas Zipes, who's a cardiologist and an expert in electrophysiology, and he has testified in court saying that excited delirium is a fictitious term. The American Medical Association actually repudiated the diagnosis in 2021, and the American College of Emergency Physicians withdrew its approval of a 2009 policy that had cited medical support for the theory. So it's something that is often listed on court records saying that when people die after being shocked by a taser, they're experiencing excited delirium. And this is like an increase in heart rate that you see and a general bodily reaction that people say can be from drugs or can be from other things that are going on in the body that then result in the person dying. However, a taser is shocking someone and sending an electric shock through their body. And that is also something that's extremely that's dangerous. If a taser strikes a person near the chest, the shock can easily reach the heart and alter its rhythm, which causes ventricular fibrillation and death. And also underlying conditions can also make tasers more deadly.
So excited delirium is a condition that many medical institutions are rejecting entirely. Is it right that policing agencies still use that to justify their uses of force?
Yeah, that'd be true. Police are still kind of using this to explain some of these scenarios that are being caught on camera where there's multiple things happening, and it's kind of to explain how someone ends up dead. I think a lot of times we think of Freddie Gray in these examples where the police are on top of somebody and there's these extra forces added. And then what really killed them is really kind of the thing. But when I talk to Dr. Carter, she's kind of explained how it's been the goalpost has been moved over time and time again of what excited delirium is. I was really talking to her about the history of this and the aftermath of some of these deaths. And it was so interesting to hear how long and just kind of how unexplained they've continued to use this, even though it doesn't make sense. But we are getting to a point now, as Sila talked about, that they're recognizing that this isn't, at least from the physician's standpoint, that this is not a recognizable cause of death.
And taking a brief step back, what led you all to begin this investigation exploring police use of tasers specifically in response to 911 mental health calls?
So back in 2022, when we were getting ready for the 988 rollout, I was focused on looking at what option people in mental health crises have for when it's happening. Who can they call? Who should they call? Things like that. And it turned out to me as a good idea in Chicago to look at, hey, where are these calls coming from geographically? And in Chicago, I was able to look around, see, I basically got a data set of the police calls, and I mapped it and I looked at where most of these calls are coming from. And it just happened to be in my neighborhood, in my own zip code, which is a very Black neighborhood. So it became my concern is that, okay, if most of these calls are coming from Black neighborhoods, what happens when police respond to these situations? And from there, I started reaching for public records that looked at the use of force, and I connected where these calls came from that were mental health crises and when the use of force were happening. And that kind of presented the scenario where we saw that not every time police come out, they use force, but when they do, it's disproportionately against Black people. And that was focused in Chicago, and it really became my question, well, is that just in Chicago, or is that across the nation? And what does that look like in different areas, different cities? And that's where we really kind of started from there, and we started looking at the 100 biggest cities. That's where we kind of roped in Medill to kind of give the students and the journalists here their input of what their specific places they came from, places they wanted to check out, places they visited, and bring in what they saw and what they could to these different areas. That's why we see so many different cities here in our reporting here, in Sila's reporting here.
And Sila, can you briefly discuss your relationship to the reporting, how you got involved? And you're a student also at the Medill School of Journalism at Northwestern that Josh was just referring to.
Yes. Yeah, so I started this my sophomore year at Medill when I was part of the Medill Investigative Program. I was very lucky to be part of a cohort that was roped into this project with Josh. Other than just looking at these cities and FOIAing a lot of cities for this data, I began looking into specific cases, and I started with Nelson Lee Graham. I was looking into a lot of places in Georgia, and Nelson Lee Graham was a man in Augusta who died in result of being shocked by a taser after his wife had already asked for an involuntary commitment to a hospital but had never received a response. And this initiated me looking into tasers across the country and noticing that there was really a pattern of tasers specifically being used against people who are experiencing mental health crises.
It seems from the results of the research that you all did that people dealing with mental health emergencies and crises are far more likely than others to be at the receiving end of a police taser. Can you share some of the statistics about that, but also talk about why that might be?
Yeah, I can explain a little bit about our data. We found when we investigated more than 100 cities, we looked into these use of force logs, and we found 450 incidents in which tasers were used on people following mental health related 911 calls since January 2020. And sometimes these cities lumped in tasers with other types of force, but we found in a lot of these cities that tasers were used in response to mental health calls at a greatly higher proportion. So for example, in Sacramento, tasers were used in response to mental health calls 46 times between 2013 and 2023, representing 2/3 of the incidents in which police used force in response to a mental health related call.
You know, I think there's been kind of this push for less than lethal force. And as we investigated all of these cities, we saw that a lot of times that they're coming up with unique ways to kind of subdue people in mental health crises. Some of them are wraps, some of them are beanbag guns. But what we've noticed more and more is that as these weapons come out, or these less than lethal force objects are coming out, that they're actually becoming used in combination. So when we looked in New Hampshire, we started to see, oh, someone was beanbagged, but at the same time, someone also fatally shot them. So what we're seeing now is that they're getting all of these less than lethal options, which the AP recent reporting has exposed that a lot of times these can also be fatal situations, even if we are advertising them as less than lethal, or the police force is advertising them as less than lethal options.
Yeah, exactly. And because Axon has marketed as less than lethal so long, and that is why they were used on people in mental health situations, because it's considered more gentle when in reality it really isn't.
Well, and let's talk a little bit about this framework of less than lethal. Certainly, it's the conversation about tasers. It's also a conversation about what Josh just referred to as wraps. Is less than lethal weaponry in the hands of police a way to create safety for the people dealing with mental health crises?
I mean, I think the first thing to say is if police respond in the normal capacity, they're usually coming with guns. So I will say in that work, we are saying we do have a better option than them coming with guns. But like I said before, they're also coming sometimes with the less than lethal force and the guns, which creates a dangerous scenario. Most of the people who have been in these situations or have witnessed these situations or have family that have been in this situation would say they would love another option that's not the police. But also, as we talk to 911 takers and all these other people, there isn't a lot of other options, or there wasn't a lot of other options. And now they are coming up with more alternative kind of responses. But also, it's not always your grandmother or your mother who's calling the police. Sometimes it's a worried person. Sometimes it's a hotel staffer. And they might be calling the police instead of knowing that there's an alternative crisis response or something like that.
Yeah, I think that it's important to note that a lot of these that are marketed as less than lethal when they truly have capacities that are lethal, as our data has shown. There were so many fatalities from the use of tasers. And I think it's important that they're not marketed as something less than lethal, and that police are told that something that can hurt people and that will hurt people, and that more emphasis is put on de-escalation techniques. A lot of places are rolling out mobile crisis units that are staffed with EMTs, that are staffed with psychologists, social workers, people who are more practiced and have more knowledge about how to handle mental health crises. And I think that police need to be more knowledgeable about how to handle mental health crises in ways that are not using force.
Well, that leads me into my next question. Thank you, Sila. Josh, you mentioned earlier that kind of the impetus for beginning this research was exploring the rollout of the 988 hotline, which, of course, is the newer National Suicide and Mental Health Emergency Hotline. One of the pieces you all published from your research was that in Spokane, Tasers were used in response to 20 mental health related 911 calls between 2018 and 2022. Seven of those cases started with 911 calls mentioning suicide. Sela, you already began to talk about some of the alternatives that are being built around responding to mental health emergency calls with EMTs or social workers. What do you all see as solutions in terms of responding to emergency mental health calls in general, and also particularly these ones that are referring to suicide, that are actually less likely to cause more harm amongst the people who are dealing with mental health crises?
My first take would be that we really need to lower the amount of times people are in mental health crises. We need to give people help before they're getting to a point where someone desperate and calling 911 or a helpline. So making sure people have resources, they have a home, they have a place to go to, they can get some help, they can get some services. But obviously that's not always available. So I think it's important and crucial that we have a number, or we advertise the number of 988 as a place where you can go, but also that there's another option, a place to go, someone who can come out. And that's not what we haven't seen with 988 across the country. All of these other options besides here's a phone number to call. But that's something that they're building out and is a hope for the future. But I think for people who are experiencing things right now, we're experiencing extremely high rates of suicidal ideation across the country right now. We need to have some of those options near us, nearby, and at least know where they exist. So making sure that they're kind of easy and accessible for anyone who's looking for them.
I completely agree. I think that mental health is a public health crisis, and that there needs to be a complete overhaul of the system that we currently have. There should be places that people can go for easily accessible, free mental health care at all hours of the day. And I think that part of that is having these mobile crisis units where there are EMTs, psychologists, mental health professionals who can respond to these calls. And maybe a police officer is involved if there's a weapon involved. But realistically, a lot of these are not public health threats. Or these are not public threats. They're a person having a health crisis, and it's not something that should be handled as if they're dangerous. They're really a danger to themselves, and that means that they need to be handled with care and with empathy and not with a weapon in response.
And you all have mentioned non-police mobile health crisis response programs that do exist in some parts of the country but are often under-resourced. I want to remind listeners that for folks in Oakland, there is a program called Oakland Macro. It may not have enough resources. It is a non-police mobile health crisis response that can be referred to from 911 dispatchers. It also has a direct phone number. So if you need to access these resources in emergency, the phone number to call is 510-446-2276. Again, that's 510-44-MACRO or 510-446-2276. Sela and Josh, is there anything else from your research or other notes that you'd like to close on as we close out this conversation?
Just to make sure you're checking out MindSight News for more installments in the Faithful Encounter series. We're up to about 6 stories now, and we're continuing to push out more that are talking about the same kind of topic.
Sela Breen and Josh McGee, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yes, thank you.
We've been in conversation about MindSight News' research on police widespread use of tasers in response to mental health emergency 911 calls. MindSight News is a nonprofit journalism site dedicated to reporting on mental health in the U.S., exposing rampant policy failures and spotlighting efforts to solve them. MindSight did this research in collaboration with the Medill School of Journalism at Northwestern University, and we've been in conversation with researcher and journalist Sela Breen, alongside Josh McGee, MindSight's Chicago Bureau Chief and reporter who focuses on the intersections of criminal justice and mental health. You've been listening to Law & Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a world where all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. You can find more information about topics and guests in this episode's show notes. Law & Disorder is produced at KPFA. That's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is co-hosted by me, Jesse Strauss, and Kat Brooks, and produced by me as well. Our show theme music is from Steve Raskin. Feel free to hit us up about something you've heard or send us a show idea at lawanddisorder@kpfa.org. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media. That's at lawanddis, D-I-S, and subscribe wherever you stream podcasts by searching for Law and Disorder with Kat Brooks. You can also find our content live on KPFA Radio or streaming at kpfa.org in the 8 a.m. Pacific hour, Mondays through Thursdays. Our show and all of KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by listeners, and if you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.